For most college students, graduating with student loan debt is unavoidable, and less privileged students have no choice but to turn to loans in hopes their college degree will act as a springboard to launch a career with a livable wage. Americans have amassed more than $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. That's according to the Federal Reserve. And that amount of debt touches every financial decision going forward. We're talking about millennial saving and spending here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Grant Sabatier. He is the founder of Millennial Money, and that's a financial advice website. His new book is called Financial Freedom, A Proven Path to All the Money You'll Ever Need. Grant, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this biggie, student loan debt. A lot of people are struggling with this debt, and for years and years after graduation, and that can make the idea of saving seem really impractical. So what advice do you have for people who are in this situation?
So first off, don't stress out too much. You're not alone. It's very common. The average millennial has over $30,000 in student loan debt. So once you realize that you're not alone, the next step is to realize that you don't need to wait to pay down your student loan debt before you start investing. And in fact, that's one of the biggest mistakes that I see millennials making, is that they think they have to wait to invest until after they've paid down all of their debt. And in reality, most millennials, it's going to take you probably at least 10 years to pay down that amount of debt consistently. Student loan debt is not the worst kind of debt. And what I mean by that is the interest rates on your student loans, they might be a little bit high, but they're definitely nothing like credit card debt. And so if you have credit card debt, in my opinion, that's much more of an emergency, and you should be paying it down first, even before you pay down your student loan debt. And credit card debt should be eliminated first, and then you should start investing. But you want to keep and start growing your net worth while also paying down your debt. So don't worry, you're not alone. And there are many proven strategies to pay back your debt a lot faster than you probably realize.
So you're putting these debts in a priority type order and keeping an eye on investing on the side there. But what about if you refinance your loans? That's a big decision, and it means you don't have access to federal repayment options anymore, including federal loan forgiveness. When is refinancing your loans an option that makes sense, and when it doesn't it make sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it really depends on your personal situation. In almost all cases, it makes sense to at least research refinancing. So there are it really comes down to a numbers game. And there are so many really reputable companies out there that will refinance your student loans and can, you know, help reduce your interest rate from, say, 7 or 8% down to 3 or 5%. And that's going to do a number of things. It's going to reduce the amount of money that you're paying each month, and you're going to pay less interest, in some cases up to $20,000 or more less interest over the term of your loan. So the idea is to get your interest rate as low as possible so it ends up having the least financial impact on you. Public and private loans are very, very different. One mistake I see people making is that they consolidate all of their types of loans together and then refinance them. But public loans, which are open to loan forgiveness programs, are different than private loans. And so it's important to look at your loan to understand which type. Most people have 3 or 4 different student loans. They don't just have one. So it's important to understand which type each is. And you can actually refinance your private student loans. And those private student loans tend to be the ones that are the most expensive. And there's nothing that says you can't just refinance those private at student loans in order to reduce the interest rate. A lot of people try to consolidate them together, and they take a public student loan that might have a low interest rate, and then they end up refinancing it when they didn't need to. Mm-hmm. Try to refinance those ones that have the biggest interest rates, because that's going to end up saving you the most money.
So really know the bones, know the anatomy of that loan and what it can do and can't do for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not nearly as complicated as you might think it is. And you know, so that's one of the things. You can figure it out relatively quickly once you understand which type of loan you have. And the nice thing is there are so many great companies out there that you can literally do this in 3 minutes online. You can get a quote for what your rate would be based on a number of factors. And so it doesn't hurt to check that out to see if you could have some savings.
Grant Sabatier is founder of Millennial Money. You can join in the conversation. Do you have a lot of student loan debt or other types of debt? Have you managed to save, or have you struggled with saving and when to save? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email your situation to ideas@wpr.org. Grant, when you're able to start saving, how do you go about figuring out a realistic goal or to set goals in the first place in terms of what you really want to accomplish in your saving?
So I think it's important to separate savings into two different buckets. A lot of people think about it all as one thing, but you really should have two buckets. And one is your short-term savings. And your short-term savings are, what are those things that you want to buy in the next, or use money for in the next 5 years or less? Things like maybe buying a car or a down payment on a house, or you know, a vacation. That's all money that you want to save in a certain type of account, typically an online savings account. And this is one of those things that makes me sad and I hate to see, is that the average American is losing money because they have their money in just a normal traditional savings account. Americans lose about $50 billion in potential interest payments by keeping their money in an account that just doesn't make much interest. There are so many amazing online savings accounts that you can get 2 to 3% of your money, which isn't a lot, but it's enough to keep up with inflation, and at least you're not losing money on your money. And that's where you should put those high interest savings accounts. Ally has a good one. There's a number of different companies. That's where you should put the money that you're going to need in the next 5 years. And then the second bucket is money that you're going to need for the long term. So money that you're investing for retirement, money that you're investing for your future self. And that's money that you can take a little bit more risk on. And in fact, you should be taking a little bit more risk on, because you want it to grow and increase the potential for it to compound over time. And this is one of the best principles of money. Einstein called compounding the eighth wonder of the world, because literally you start investing money, and the more early and often that you can invest, the longer your money has to grow and the more it will compound. And so that's one of the things. The younger you are, you should start investing today, even if it's just $5, $5 a month, $5 a week, $10 a month. That money is going to grow and compound over your lifetime, and it could be worth 5 to 6 to 7 times more in 20 and 30 years, but you have to start. And that's one of the things. Time is on your side. And for that long-term money, those long-term investments, even if you make very little money today, $5 over 20 or 30 years each week is going to add up to a lot of money.
We're looking at avenues in which millennials can save more, build up more of a nest egg early on. Grant Sabatier is our guide. His new book is called Financial Freedom. His website is Millennial Money, and you can join in. Do you carry student loan debt or other types of debt? Have you managed to save, or have you struggled with saving? How do you work through this debt? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation on saving and investing, especially for millennials, in just a minute on the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. Just over 60% of millennials with debt don't know when or if they'll ever be able to pay off what they owe. And that's according to a recent report from creditcards.com. And consider this, the average millennial carried about $36,000 in personal debt last year. That doesn't include mortgages. And that comes from a study by Northwestern Mutual. We take these statistics into account as we talk millennial saving and investing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent Grant Sabatier is our guide. He's founder of a personal finance website geared toward millennials. You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Do you have tips for socking away money, even if you're on a tight budget or dealing with debt? What questions do you have about saving money while also dealing with student loans? Call in with your situation, 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to the phones now with Jordan joining us from Madison. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning.
So what's your situation like?
Okay, so I went to law school and I accumulated over $100,000 in student loan debt, but I went there with the understanding that I would be able to enroll in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program because I really wanted to work in a hospital. And I do. I work for a 501c3 organization. And I have been meeting the public service loan forgiveness requirements annually. I even check up on it every 6 months just to make sure I'm meeting the requirements. And I hear all these stories of, you know, I think CNN reported that 30,000 people applied for the program last November and only 90 were approved or something like that. And so I'm just wondering, it's nerve-wracking. I could go into private industry and make more money and actually pay on those loans, or I could stay in the public service loan forgiveness program. I just worry it's going to be abolished or something will happen specifically such that it's not available.
So wanting to know how reliable is loan forgiveness here? Grant?
Yeah, I think it's pretty reliable for now, but like anything in life, you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket. And one of the things that I encourage people in your situation to do is try to find a way just to diversify your income streams a little bit. And so you don't have to go all in, for example, on private practice in order to make some money on the side, especially with the services you have. You know, I see every day people who are working in the public sector in situations like you who start little side hustles where they're offering legal consulting, legal counseling to people and making money that way in order just to pay off their student loans. And this is one of the things, especially in your local community, there in some cases is more demand than ever for a variety of legal type services. And you can make, you know, $200 to $300 per hour on the side, maybe working 5 to 10 hours a week. And yes, that means you have to spend a little bit more time working, but it also will help give you a taste of the private sector as well to see if you'd even like making that shift. And so it's a win-win. You can make some extra money specifically to pay down your student loans and fast track that process. And you can get a taste of whether you like working in the legal field outside of the public sector. So it's really a win-win in that case. And that's what I say, you know, never put all of your eggs in one basket, because if the program does get abolished and you haven't built another income stream or made those inroads into the private sector, you know, you're going to be starting from scratch. And so hedge your bets in this case and also get the added benefit of being able to pay down your loans faster with that additional side hustle income.
Well, let's bounce back to Jordan here for a moment. Jordan, have you signed anything with the company you work for that would prohibit you from doing perhaps a side hustle in legal work?
No, I have not. But I think then the next question for me would be, the way public service loan forgiveness works is you have to be on a certain kind of payment plan. And they actually are much lower payment plans than what a typical person paying back their student loans would pick. So I'm not at all making maximum payments on my student loans. Would you recommend still making, I guess, my IBR-driven payment monthly?
Yeah, so like a lot of things with money, it comes down to, it's a numbers game. And so you want to try to pay still as much as you can on that loan, because over the long period of time, even with the forgiveness, it's going to reduce the amount of interest that you pay. And that's why making money on the side is nice, because it can fast track that pay down process. You should always, with one caveat, you know, you shouldn't wait to invest. And that's one of the things. $100,000, while it's certainly a lot of student loan debt, it's not an emergency situation, in my opinion. That's something that it might take you quite a while to pay down, but you should still be investing. And so making that minimum payment, trying to pay more while also still investing in, you know, either a 401k or a 403b, whatever retirement type plan that your employer offers. If they don't offer a retirement plan, then open a Roth IRA and just start investing, you know, $10 a week, because you don't want to wait until you've paid down that $100,000 debt before you start investing, because it's going to take you quite a while to pay it down, and you don't want to have missed out on that growth opportunity for your investments and paying yourself first, not just paying down the debt. And that's one of my biggest challenges with all of these debt studies, is that everything about millennials is always about debt. And yes, debt is bad, debt is tough, but the conversation should be more focused on how do we start saving for our future, not just paying for, you know, our past education. And so that simple mindset shift, don't let debt straddle you, even if you have a lot of debt. You have many years, you're going to be able to pay it off. And the exciting thing is there's still amazing opportunities to invest and for your money to grow over the next 30 years. And don't stress too much about it.
Jordan, thanks for bringing your situation forward here. Grant, let's talk a moment about investing, which is a big issue. There's an element of risk in investing that might turn people off, and it's less straightforward than opening a savings account. And there's larger initial investments, higher minimums. The least amount of money you can get into in a Vanguard mutual fund is $1,000. Most funds start with 3,000 minimums. How can young people without means and who may not have experience in investing get started?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So investing, it's important to note, is not gambling. It's not like buying a lottery ticket, and a lot of people think that it is. Investing is where you're minimizing your risk in order to maximize your reward. And there are some investments, specifically stocks, bonds, and real estate, that have historically performed really well. And they're much safer because we know more about them. It's very different than like going and investing, you know, in an old car, for example. And there are so many easy ways to invest today. The first place that you should always start, if you work for an employer that offers a 401k, a 403b, or a 457 plan, that is where you should be starting to invest, especially for your future. And one of the things, a lot of people, you know, they say, I have, you know, $100 to invest, and they go out and they, you know, open an account with one of these free trading stock apps, and then they try to buy stock. If you have, this is important, if you have less than $5,000 to invest, you should not be buying individual stocks, because an individual stock, it can go up and down over the long term. You never want to invest in just one company. The money you're investing for your retirement, it's if it goes down, if you put money in and it goes down tomorrow, if it goes down over the next 3 years, that's not important. What's important is what it does over the long term. And over any 15-year period in history in the United States, the stock market over that period of time has averaged about 7% growth and compounding after inflation. And so even if the stock market might be, you know, up 20%, 10% one day and down 30% one year, over the long term, the stock market continues to grow and compound. And so the money you invest in your retirement, put it away, forget it, don't look at it every day, and first invest in those accounts that have tax advantages. So if your company offers a 401k, a 457, or a 403b, that is where you want to invest. And they're going to have options in those accounts that you can invest in. I recommend an S&P 500 index fund or a total stock market index fund, which offers instant diversification because you're investing in a lot of companies at once. So then it's not going to matter over the long term if a company goes out of business or if one thrives, because you're investing in a large enough group of stocks that you're getting the diversification to invest in the growing U.S. economy. And often your 401k or 403b plan will have those options. One of the best calls that you can make is, you know, 20 minutes with your 401k provider, asking them how you can invest in those accounts. And so the question of where should I invest? If you don't have those options, the next option is to open a Roth IRA. And these accounts have tax advantages. And you want to take every advantage of tax-advantaged accounts, which is why you don't just want to go open an app and invest $10. So that's really where you want to start.
Well, Grant, thank you so much for making time for us, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate being on.
Grant Sabatier is founder of Millennial Money, author of Financial Freedom, a proven path to all the money you will ever need. Coming up next, we take a look at the latest on the Russia investigation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. President Trump's nominee to serve as the next Attorney General, William Barr, plans to tell Congress today at his confirmation hearing that Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian meddling in the 2016 election should continue and that the public should be informed of the results of the probe. His two-day hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee begins today, and we're looking at the latest developments in the Russia probe here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're going to Bruce Gentleson for an update now. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He was a former senior advisor to the director of policy planning at the State Department between 2009 and 2011. And his latest book is called The Peacemakers: Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. Bruce, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be with you again.
So William Barr, President Trump's nominee for Attorney General, has known and worked with Robert Mueller for 30 years. They worked together at Justice under President George Bush. And so in that written testimony released yesterday, Barr stated that it is in the best interest of everyone, the president, Congress, and the American people, that this matter be resolved by allowing the special counsel to complete his work. So if confirmed, what does Barr's position mean for the Mueller investigation?
It was very encouraging, and I think it protected him from a very contentious hearing. There'll still be issues, but you know, lawyers have been saying there's some flexible clauses in there. At one point he says, as long as there are things that are under my jurisdiction, and he's known to have a conception of presidential power that's very expansive. So it doesn't totally eliminate the possibility that either he might do something to stop it, or he might get out of the way if the president does. But it's a move in what many people think is the right direction.
We learned over the weekend that the FBI is investigating whether the president was working on behalf of the Russian government. So what is new and remarkable here?
Well, I think the very fact that the FBI would respond to that right after the firing of their director, Jim Comey, and the president has said they're dirty cops or scoundrels, and people just stop and think about that. You know, anybody in the FBI that suggests that to a supervisor knows what they're proposing, and it's, you know, it's a big deal. Their own job is at risk if it's believed they're doing it for the wrong reasons. So I think it really shows the severity of the reasons for doing it had built up over time. We also had the revelation this weekend that the president had seized the notes of the interpreter that was with him when he met with Vladimir Putin. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, why would a president do that? It clearly wasn't to check the grammatical correctness or the accuracy of the translation. There was something there that he didn't want anybody else to know, which is why he made the meeting one-on-one in the first place. And, you know, each piece of evidence here is not in itself a smoking gun, but there sure is a lot that's accumulating.
And so we knew that there was the investigation into the Trump campaign about Russian meddling, but this investigation seems to be getting narrower and narrower now as these new revelations come out.
Yeah, some of it actually goes further back. You know, there have been some stories that they're looking at the financial history. It was reported, just as one fact, from 2003 to 2017, Russians, mostly oligarchs, made 86 all-cash purchases worth over $100 million at Trump properties. It's a classic money laundering technique, and the two Trump sons, Donald and Eric, before the presidential campaign, had boasted that they were getting their funding from Russia, not out of American banks. So the sense is Mueller is going to have a context for this that, you know, gives sort of a continuity from the way he handled his business, Trump, to what he was doing during his campaign.
So the FBI here in its investigation looks at criminal and counterintelligence elements. What does the counterintelligence and the criminal elements, what do those labels mean?
Counterintelligence is really, it could be something that is below the bar of treason, but is a collusion with the Russians that's against the American national interest and what the president's obligations are. And so we've had all these moves to, you know, maybe even get out of NATO, to not do anything when the Russians fired on ships off the Ukraine coast. One thing after another, apparently the president was also using his private cell phone to talk to Putin. I got to believe that the NSA has a way of picking that up. The criminal is more the obstruction of justice, the things that are within our domestic politics and law. So the two complement each other, but they have this distinction.
So is the FBI concerned about national security here related to President Trump's actions, as we know so much?
I think it's fair to say definitely yes. They're not the only ones. You know, many other parts of the American intelligence community, the FBI has a certain jurisdiction. The CIA has another. The National Security Agency has another. And I don't think it's an exaggeration, and it's not being partisan, to say that there's plenty of basis here for concern. What the actual evidence is, we learn a bit from media investigations. We'll learn a lot more from the House of Representatives now that the Democrats can actually call witnesses and the Republican chairs are not there to block. And we'll definitely learn a lot from Robert Mueller's investigation.
Talking with Bruce Gentleson, he's a political scientist at Duke University, looking at the latest developments in the Russia probe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been watching in this investigation, in Robert Mueller's investigation, and how have you seen it change, evolve over time? Are there developments that have really come to life for you? Questions you have about it, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Bruce, there has been some debate in the intelligence community about this particular inquiry. What are law enforcement leaders saying about the necessity of a probe into the president's actions in relation to Russia?
There are so many pieces of evidence here that it would be a disservice to our political system, the Durr Constitution, not to investigate. Most people genuinely believe, given Robert Mueller's track record, he's not a Democrat, he's not a partisan, he served the country throughout his career, including being a Marine, that he will not bring charges if there's not a basis for it. And I think what the Attorney General nominee said yesterday was acknowledging that, that if there was an effort to block Mueller's report, that the long-term damage to American politics, we've had so much damage already. You know, it's one thing to disagree with the president's policies, but the way that our institutions, to have no government functioning. I asked somebody the other day if they could think of another example of any country that had shut down its government. And nobody could think of an example. I mean, it's just crazy. And it undermines so much that will be problems well after Donald Trump is gone, whether that's soon or after 2024.
Well, the president has really responded to a lot on Twitter and provoked on Twitter as well in responding to this investigation. What is he saying about the turns in this investigation? What do we know from his Twitter account?
He calls people names. What was interesting was it was even on Fox News that he got asked the direct question by his interviewer, have you been working for the Russians? And his response was not no. It was that's an insulting question. Twitter is very helpful for the president because you put things out there, and you don't have to take a counter question from a reporter or anybody else. So it fits his modus operandi that, you know, he can just lash out all over the place, and he knows everybody pays attention to it. I'm sure he doesn't read the responses you get on Twitter. And he stirs the pot, and this whole name-calling and, you know, efforts, it may be running its course. People may be getting to the point. When he gave a speech on TV the other night about the wall, apparently one poll showed only 2% of the American public were convinced. So his political techniques may be losing their strength.
So Robert Mueller is tasked with answering the question of whether President Trump was working on Russia's behalf by the time his investigation concludes. When will Mueller arrive at a conclusion?
You know, we keep seeing reports that words are used like soon or imminent. And you and I and your listeners both know that those words don't have a precise nature. Mueller has done an amazing job, if you think about it, of having few, if any, leaks coming out. I mean, how do you do that in today's media age? So we really don't know. It's not going to go on forever. And I think it's really, my own sense is every time they think they're getting closure, they find another cause for concern. And some of it is Russia, some of it is obstruction of justice, some of it is other issues. So it's really, really hard to say. Every time I hear somebody say, you know, an informed source told me it's going to be a matter of weeks, we go through those weeks and it keeps going. So credit to Mueller and his team for keeping the lid on things.
Well, Tim from Whitewater called in to say he says he's not a fan of President Trump, but he does think this seems to be pretty typical Washington infighting here. What is your response to Tim?
You know, I have to say, you know, I've had many presidents that I've disagreed with on policy, but I think the kind of issues that have been raised here go well beyond Washington politics. They are genuinely dangerous to the country and to the world. And I really think there's a difference here between do you agree or disagree with his, you know, ban on Muslims and others for travel? I don't agree with it, but I can see people having a debate about that. But this is questions about possible relationships with a country that's been our adversary for, you know, for many, many decades, firing officials, you know, obstruction of justice. Those are very different, and it's true that we've had so much, you know, gridlock going on in Washington, it's hard not to dismiss it. But I really hope people, you know, see how important these are to the future of the country that we want to have for our kids and grandkids.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Kate.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Areas of expertise include U.S. politics, diplomacy, and international relations. He's the author of the book, The Peacemakers: Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A 21-year-old man who said he kidnapped 13-year-old Jamie Kloss and killed her parents was formally charged yesterday in Barron County Circuit Court. And the criminal complaint gives us more insight into what transpired on October 15th when Jamie Kloss's parents were murdered in their home and Jamie was kidnapped in a matter of 4 minutes. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been covering the developments. Rich, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be back.
Well, we spoke yesterday morning, and help us understand what we've learned since we last spoke with the criminal complaint coming out.
Well, we've learned quite a bit about what transpired the night of the murders and the kidnapping. We learned that Jake Thomas Patterson first saw Jamie Kloss as she got off of a bus. He was driving to a cheese factory in Almena. He said he worked there for about a day or two. And when he saw her get off of the bus, he was behind the bus on Highway 8 in the area. And he said that's when he knew she was the one that he was going to take. The complaint doesn't elaborate on why he wanted to take someone, but that's when he first saw Jamie Kloss. We also learned more about what happened the night that Jamie Kloss was taken, and it was a pretty tough read. He came to the house, the father, James Kloss, came to the front door and apparently thought that Patterson was an officer of some sort, Patterson shot James through the door and made its way into the house after shooting the deadbolt off of the house's door. Then he went through the house looking for Jamie, and Jamie and her mother had barricaded themselves in a bathroom. And Patterson broke down the door and then made her ask the mother to tape Jamie's mouth shut. And when she wasn't able to do that, he did it himself, restrained Jamie with tape, and then shot the mother.
And this happened in a matter of minutes?
He said it happened in about 4 minutes, and he dragged Jamie out, threw her in the trunk of his car, which he had prepared extensively so that she couldn't get out. He got rid of the safety release inside the trunk that he called the kidnapping handle, you know, the glow-in-the-dark T-cord pull mechanism. And he said as he was driving away, it wasn't 20 seconds until he passed law enforcement. You know, the authorities were on their way, sirens blazing, so he yielded for the police. One of the officers recognized they saw this lone car on the highway, but they didn't really know what to think of it at the time. They noticed that there was no license plate. That was one of the other things that Patterson did, was he took his license plates off the car. He disabled the light above the license plate on the back of the car, disabled the dome light so that no one would see him getting in and out of the vehicle.
He did a lot of preparation for this.
Yes. Yeah. He also, you know, shaved his head and face. He took a shower, and all in an effort to minimize the possibility that hair or other DNA evidence would be left at the scene. He put on gloves to wipe down the shotgun that he used. It was his father's shotgun, apparently. Wiped down the shells even, and just went to great lengths to try to avoid leaving any trace.
Did we learn more about what happened during those 88 days as Jamie was gone?
Yeah. Patterson and Kloss, you know, testimony from Patterson and Kloss to investigators lays out that the home in Gordon, he had a room in the basement, and he was keeping Jamie in his room, basically. And whenever he had to leave, he had had a space underneath his bed. It was a twin bed. So he would make her go under the bed, and he would block her in with tote bins filled with heavy weights, like for weightlifting. And he said that way, you know, it was hard for her to get out, but also if she tried to, he would be able to tell that the weights had been moved. He made quite clear that, you know, if she was going to try to escape, he would do bad things to her, and it seemed like he was really using a lot of, a lot of fear to try to keep her from thinking about escaping.
Talking with Rich Kramer, he's WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire, and we're going through the details of the abduction and captivity of Jamie Kloss in the first court hearing yesterday, where Jake Patterson was formally charged with Jamie's abduction and the killing of Jamie's parents, James and Denise Kloss. Rich, what have Patterson's attorneys said in recent days?
Well, I heard one reference, not a whole lot, to be honest, but I did hear one of the defense attorneys, which are, they're public defenders, one of them were quoted as saying, this is a tragic situation. They mentioned something about, you know, they're not sure where they would have to go to get a fair trial. So it almost sounded like they were alluding to maybe a change of venue, but there haven't been any motions filed as to that. But Patterson has admitted to everything. In fact, in the criminal complaint, it almost reads as if he's bragging to investigators. So he told them where to find everything. They've got the evidence, and they've also got the testimony from Jamie Kloss.
Did he say anything yesterday in court?
Not really. He just he waived his right to a preliminary investigation. And he basically, you know, the judge asked, if you do you understand, you know, that you're waiving your right? And he said, yes, sir. That was about it. Not much happens at these preliminary hearings. It's basically just kind of reading the charges against the defendant. In the courtroom, you know, most of the media was kept out of the courtroom for this, but when the families left, I mean, there was a lot of hurt that you could see on the people's faces.
How is the community reacting to yesterday's events?
Well, I didn't really get a chance to get out and talk to community members. Yesterday, I was at the Justice Center and writing up stories, but the community as a whole was just overjoyed at Jamie's return, which we talked about yesterday morning. But
yeah.
These details are pretty horrific, so I imagine it's causing some pain. I mean, even for the reporters covering it, it's been really emotional.
What about bail?
The judge or the state prosecutors asked for a $5 million cash bail to be set, and the judge agreed. And the reasoning for that, the prosecutors say, is all of the steps that he took to avoid detection. It's obvious that he didn't want to be caught. So they said, because of this, and because of the fact that he doesn't really have any ties to Barron County, they needed the excessively large cash bail in order to keep him from fleeing.
They think he's a flight risk.
Absolutely.
So as this investigation proceeds, as this court case proceeds, what are you watching as the case moves forward?
Well, the next thing to watch, I believe, is if there are going to be any charges coming from Douglas County. That is where Jamie was held. She was held in the town of Gordon, which is in Douglas County. Yesterday at the press conference, a brief press conference after the initial appearance, the prosecution, the district attorney for Barron County brought up the district attorney for Douglas County, who said charges may be coming in Douglas County. And, you know, that makes sense because it's a whole nother set of crimes that potentially happened up there. There's a lot of questions about whether Jamie was assaulted by this man, and they wouldn't elaborate on that, but maybe if there's child, you know, endangerment or you know, maltreatment sort of charges, those would come from Douglas County because that's where the crimes would have happened.
Rich, thank you so much for joining us and for your reporting.
Thank you.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's host of the regional program, The West Side. We've been talking about the details of the Jamie Kloss abduction and captivity, the first court hearing yesterday where Jake Patterson was formally charged with Jamie's abduction and the killing of Jamie's parents, James and Denise Kloss, on October 15th. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.